Welcome to the Space Between podcast, from science fiction to science future. And now your hosts, Mike and Mare.
Hey, listeners, you are with Mike and Mare in the Space Between podcast. And it's been a little while since we've broadcasted. I think end of January was our last one, Mike.
I think so, yeah. But we're ready to come back with a lot of interesting stuff.
Gee, has anything happened since we've been broadcasting?
A few things have happened.
Not to mention the entire Picard series, which we'll be getting to in our next episode. But yeah, some pretty big things happening in the world. So for this episode, we are going to focus on pandemics. We're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of what viruses are and what makes a pandemic, because that's something that literally every other podcast is doing right now. But because we're interested in science fiction and science reality, we'll talk about how these pandemics have been portrayed in movies and television, and just a few kind of contemporary relevancies to that, which I think will be kind of fun.
Yeah, and I think we're like hitting the perfect, you know, more or less middle ground. You know, we can't get away from the news of everything that's going on, but hopefully we can provide a little bit of an escape by looking at some of these topics from the science fiction perspective. You know, that we so enjoy talking about science fiction. So, you know, we're recognizing we can't totally get away from it. But let's look at it through science fiction and some modes that we enjoy, like Star Trek. So,
yeah, exactly. I mean, there's plenty of things that that are certainly stressful and not positive about this entire situation for everybody. And so, you know, we want to bring kind of a little bit more interesting side of fiction and science fiction when it comes to pandemics, and some levity with that, but we're obviously not dismissing the fact that this is a very stressful time for many of you. And we've all been taking to it in our own ways. I've been able to get some more writing done and more reading, and that's been nice. That's been one bit of silver lining of being isolated for the last few weeks. What about you, Mike? What have you been up to?
Well, I mentioned earlier that I ordered a handheld HEPA filter vacuum cleaner on Amazon today. So that is a big step.
Excellent.
So, I mean, it might sit in a box for a month or so, I don't know. But you know, I've done that, and I've done some coursework that I'm doing online. And so been trying to stay productive, trying to keep a routine, and actually been doing some Star Trek viewing parties. Ron, our friend from Vegas, has been setting those up. So almost like every other night, people are watching Star Trek together through the Netflix party app.
Yeah, I saw that. And you told me about that. I need to jump in and join sometime, because that looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. And then
good rewatch.
Yeah, it's fun because you can chat back and forth as you're watching, you know, the episode. And then, you know, when Riker wears one of those silky pajamas strolling around the Enterprise, you can be like, did you really go out in that? So...
You know, it's funny because I've actually done that sort of a thing with friends of mine over the years. A close friend of mine now, she and I will sometimes watch a movie or watch a TV series virtually together. Like, we'll just be on Facebook Messenger chatting as we just kind of sync it up and start playing it at the same time on our respective TVs. And a couple friends of mine did that with Harry Potter several years ago. So it's like, I've kind of done this, but it's great that Netflix is setting up a platform to do that more consistently and a little bit more easily. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's really cool because I'm not sure if it's Netflix or a third party, but basically you just get the link and you kind of all get into the virtual theater together, and people say hi and hello before the episode starts. And then everyone can just kind of share their thoughts as the episode goes on.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, it's a great way for us to keep connecting, and it's kind of cool to see different means of connection popping up. I saw this link that was ways that you can play card games, like, you know, something like Go Fish or something more fun like Cards Against Humanity, virtually, like online with friends. And so things, you know, technology is stepping in when it comes to connectedness. And really, if there's any time in history where you can be isolated but be connected. You know, we've got so many means of doing that. It's pretty remarkable. So in some ways, I feel very grateful that, you know, this is happening during a period of time where we can still maintain a lot of that connection with each other.
Important. And I've done other things too, like Google Hangouts, you know, with a couple of friends and wear some Star Trek costumes and have drinks. And, you know, just getting to watch Star Trek together virtually, because it's so funny how, like, you and I have actually never watched Star Trek together. You know what I mean? Like,
that's
so many
true.
Of our friends from Man, Vegas,
we gotta
we're all friends
pick
of,
that.
We're all fans of Star Trek, but we rarely have watched it together, so.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so, again, a little bit of silver lining from this is that you can forge some of those connections
Absolutely.
For the first time. So speaking of dealing with isolation, I know that you saw a really cool New York Times article from astronaut Scott Kelly
yes,
about
well,
this.
Well, you know, definitely, you know, all of us who are working from home and, you know, kind of isolating ourselves to maintain social distancing, you know, that's hard because we miss the normal interaction that we have with people. You just kind of take that for granted. And the number of people you come into contact with on a daily basis drops down significantly. But I think, you know, if there's anyone who are experts in isolation over long periods of time, it's definitely got to be our astronauts, because, you know, where we may have to do this for several months, you know, here's a guy, Scott Kelly, who did it for a year where, you know, he was really only interacting with a very small number of people over the course of a year, you know, way up in space. So he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and he suggested four things. And those four things for people, you know, as we try to isolate ourselves, are following a schedule, pacing yourself, going outside, and considering getting a hobby. So those are the four things he suggested: schedule, pacing, go outside, and get a hobby. So I have a little bit of a routine that I try to follow. You know, when I take my breaks during the day, you know, I don't commute to work anymore, obviously, but I do try to get out for at least like a 10 or 15 minute walk. How about yourself, Meredith? Do you have a schedule that you try and follow right now?
Not at the moment, because we've been on spring break. So we've all kind of been in this just chill out and relax and enjoy not being on a schedule mode. But starting not this week, but the week after, so the week of April 6th, we will be returning to teaching online. And so we're definitely going to have a schedule in place, especially since, you know, my husband and I will both be teaching from home and we've got our 6-year-old at home. So that's going to sort of naturally come into place where we're going to have to make a schedule a little bit more routine. And so, yeah, but I mean, for the last 2 weeks, we've just been, we've been total slugs, like sleeping late and watching whatever and reading. And I kind of got into a little bit of a routine with my writing, but it's been kind of slackerville over here in the Michael household. It's funny though, because we talk about astronauts and isolation. So my husband used to be a nuclear reactor operator on the submarines in the Navy. And so he's very, very familiar with isolation and staying in, you know, close quarters. And, you know, I don't have that experience, but I have, and I continue to apply to be an astronaut. So it's like, on the one hand, I'm looking for that kind of isolation and he's experienced it. And so, you know, many of our friends are struggling with this social distancing, but we're just like, hey, this is fine.
Well, I think I remember, you know, that's one of the things that they're trying to promote in New York State is for people to just, you know, they call it the Strive for Five. So, you know, five people that you will reach out to every day, you know, and to consider people who are living alone or feeling isolated. You know, and then at the same time, also making sure that you have time for yourself, especially if you're living in a small area with just a few folks.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And it's good to see that extension of empathy and care. I've seen a lot of people on social media do that, and they've just kind of put themselves out there like, hey, if you're having a hard time with this, so you just want to release some thoughts or emotions, I'm here.
Well, so he said, you know, follow a schedule, pace yourself. So I guess, you know, like you got to think of this situation as a marathon and not a sprint. And I know you know about marathons. How many have you done?
Yes. 10.
So how many miles is that? That's 10 times
26.2, so 260. I mean, that's of racing, but I actually had one coming up in May, but it's been canceled just like all the other races. So
just randomly, but how do you, like in a marathon, how do you pace yourself? Because I imagine, you know, when they say, you know, go, gosh, the adrenaline must be there to just like go as fast as you can. How do you pace yourself?
Well, there's a saying in marathon running, you kind of divide the race into thirds and you run the first third with your head and you're careful and cautious and you stick to your pace no matter what. You don't, you know, of course there's that adrenaline, but you don't get so caught up that you overdo it. The second third you run with your gut. So you sort of assess, you know, where you are, and how you're feeling and strategize from there. And the last third with your heart, you just kind of, whatever you have left, you're putting out and not leaving anything behind. But it's not as simple as that. I've never run a race that's as simple as that. For example, the Boston Marathon starts on this pretty steep downhill. And, I remember the first time I did that was like, oh God, how am I going to hold myself back? Like the first mile and a half is downhill. And then you have to, you got to gain some sort of steady pacing, because then, you know, by miles like 13, 14, you start having some pretty intense uphills. So it depends on the course, but it's a lot of training your brain to focus on the right things and avoid the wrong things.
That sounds like that would be very useful advice for us right now.
Exactly. Right. And it's, and sometimes it's just the training of knowing when thoughts are creeping into your head that are not helpful. In a marathon, sometimes that sounds like just quit, just walk off the course right now. You're done. You know, my brain does all kinds of horrible things to me, and it tells me just how awful I am and how stupid I am for even starting this race. You know, I mean, there's so many things that happen, but it's just a matter of recognizing those thoughts, accepting that they're there, and then ignoring them and saying, I'm going to choose to think something else because I have to. And I've trained and I've put so much of myself into this. I am not going to let a few stray thoughts derail me at this point.
That's also just a great reminder. I use the Calm app, and you know, they're always reminding you to be gentle with yourself, you know, because I think definitely, you know, none of us have ever lived through a situation like this. So, you know, giving yourself some space, some allowance, you know, and recognizing those negative thoughts when they come in, and realizing that that's not you. That's just kind of probably part of what we're all going through. Interesting that, the book that Scott Kelly, of course, wrote on his year in space is called Endurance. So that's probably pretty appropriate.
It's exactly appropriate. And that's kind of how we have to think about it now. I mean, we don't know precisely how long this is going to last. Some of those details change day to day. And we have to simply just keep following that advice of being kind to yourself and realizing that you can't control what this is going to play out into in the near future. So focus on the things you can control.
And again, his last two pieces of advice are going outside, which I know you're doing, running a lot more. You know, I'm walking a little bit more and getting a hobby. And I've started drawing again, so I've been doing more of that. Yeah. And
you've been that's
doing
great. Writing.
So we've both been doing stuff with hobbies.
We have. Yeah. And I wrote a couple of short stories a few years back and a nonfiction book about running post-pregnancy. And I've had this novel that I've been working on for about 12 years. And so I haven't made a ton of progress with the novel, unfortunately, but I did start another short story. It's actually a sequel to my very first short story, which is called The Companion. And it's a science fiction about a abandoned lunar base. And my sequel is called The Illuminated. And so it's a sequel to The Companion. However, it could be read on its own and hopefully still be interesting. So I'm hoping that'll be published in the next couple of weeks.
That's so cool.
I also, in terms of hobbies, I recently ordered on Amazon a 12-inch steel tongue drum. Are you familiar with a tongue drum? So it's like a small, almost like a kettle drum, but it's not concave, it's convex. And it's got these like little cutouts in the top of it. And each one you would strike either with a stick or with your hands, and it makes a different sound. So it's kind of like inverted kettle drum.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was used once on like Star Trek Voyager or Deep Space Nine as like an alien instrument. That sounds like something you'd see on the promenade.
It looks super, cool. Bajoran. Like, I feel like this is something the Bajorans would do. It's cool. So I'm going to learn how to play the tongue drum.
Is that from a particular culture, or is it from somewhere in the United States or abroad? Or
I don't actually know. I should read up on that before I start to play.
Maybe we'll have an inaugural performance.
Yes, I should do that. We could do a little talent show at some point and showcase some of the various things we've been doing.
Definitely.
In our time.
Talent show.
Isolation talent show. I like it. So why don't we take a quick break? And when we come back, we are going to get into what we initially described, pandemics in Hollywood, what outbreaks of viruses have traditionally looked like in movies and
on TV. All right,
let's
do it. Okay, and we are back, and we are going to start talking about viruses as portrayed in Hollywood. But before we jump into that, we both just wanted to share with you guys a little bit of context of why we're interested in this and what our backgrounds are in it.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of a, you know, who do we think we are talking about these movies and viruses and whether or not they're accurate or not. So we can tell you a little bit about that.
Sure.
So Mike, you just started taking this awesome class on epidemiology, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think the way I would describe myself is a tourist in infectious disease. So, you know, obviously not an expert, but I'd consider myself what I'd say a tourist in it. And I started taking a course. I actually took a graduate course when I was in grad school called Epidemics and Dynamics and then Social Networks. And so essentially looking at epidemics and disease and how they spread through social networks, which is a relatively new field of study, but some really interesting stuff. And then, you know, with everything that's going on, I think that one of the best ways to prepare ourselves is just to make sure we're informed. And there's a great course, the one that you mentioned that I started taking, called Epidemics and the Dynamics of Infectious Disease, which is provided by Penn State through Coursera Online, and just really user-friendly, you know, collection of about several modules, but 6-minute and 10-minute videos, everything from pathogens to vaccines and the history of epidemiology. And that's, you know, of course, the detective study of where diseases start. So, you know, kind of a tourist of this whole topic, but very interested. And that's the beginning and end of my background in this area, which is different for you because you are actually a scientist.
Well, yes, but I'm also, I mean, I haven't been a researcher in a very long time, but I'm a science educator. So the courses that I most focus on are AP Biology and AP Chemistry. And so if you describe yourself as a tourist, I would describe myself as a tour guide in the sense that I have in order to teach these courses, I have to have a strong breadth of knowledge. I don't have nearly the depth as, you know, an epidemiologist would. So, you know, there's a little bit of a jack of all trades, master of none in what I do. That being said, you know, in order to teach students, in order to teach high school students, but technically AP Biology and AP Chemistry are college level, you know, we have to stay very up to speed on, you know, recent and emerging developments. And so I actually just taught my AP Biology students about viruses like a month and a half ago. And I remember telling them, hey, you should go watch this movie, Contagion. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Here we are. When we'll get to Contagion later. But so anyway, my graduate school work was in a funky combination of biology, specifically microbiology. So I worked in a microbiology lab for a while at the University of South Florida and studied a little bit of pathogens. My focus was actually on the bacteria you find at the bottom of the sea in hydrothermal vents. but we certainly had, you know, there was some definite crossover between pathogens and what I was working on there. But then the other side of my graduate time was studying a little bit of aerospace and how we operate in space. One of my favorite classes that I took for my master's was on space medicine, which was really fun and just fascinating. And it kind of makes me both want to pursue space travel myself, but also run screaming the other direction when you learn some of the things that happens to the human body. And we've talked about that in the past as well.
So has that been your experience, that learning more has kind of made you more cautious, or?
It makes me have a greater appreciation for the complexity of all of this, of how organisms function and how quickly things can change. It's remarkable. It's really, really remarkable. And so from the standpoint of a biologist, it's no surprise that we are where we are with this, because, you know, it's really, from an ecology standpoint, this is what large populations, large dense populations do. Sure. In the history of life, whenever you have a very large, very dense population of a certain species, nature has a way of dealing with it. And viruses and infectious diseases is precisely one of those ways. So it's kind of only a matter of time before something like this happens. That being said, it's still sort of amazing to me how rapidly this unfolded. Because, you know, you and I have been through SARS and MERS and a couple of these outbreaks, swine flu.
H1N1, yep.
Right. And so none of it escalated to this degree of social distancing. You know, it was one of those things that if you had it, okay, you went to the doctor, it was dealt with, but we didn't change our behaviors. We didn't change our lifestyles for those things. So this really is in a whole different category. So that's one of the things that I've kind of emphasized to my students when we've communicated in the last few weeks, is that, you know, it's an opportunity to really get a grasp of how intense infectious diseases can be and how tenuous our ability to fight it really is when you look at epidemiology, which is what you're learning about right now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's really fascinating, you know, to look at some of the first cases where they kind of did this disease detecting kind of stuff, which actually goes back to some of the first cholera outbreaks in England in the 1800s. And it was, I mean, I want to say spoiler alert, but it's been like hundreds of years. So, you know, at this point, I think it's fair game. But, you know, really, like, this one of these cholera outbreaks was traced back to there was a young child that died, and the woman had taken the diaper that had vomit and fecal matter to dump into a cesspit, which was actually located next to a water pump. And the brick was corroding, and so there was seepage from the cesspit into the water pump. And that's actually what, you know, contributed to that. Pretty crazy. Wow. You know, and yeah, and yeah. So, you know, and it's looking at, like, well, what are the different ways that we can make a difference here? And of course, there's, everyone's focused on the medicine aspect, but I think now more than ever, we're focused on the behavioral aspects of what we can do in our own personal lives to stop the spread. And I think, you know, as we're moving into the topic of looking at how sci-fi has portrayed viruses, generally, I think movies are very focused on a singular character or a singular vaccine, or, you know, we must get this sample to somewhere to save the day, which I think we're seeing is not really the totality of how real situations work.
Right, exactly. It's it tends to be pretty complex. I know that in terms of COVID-19, they had started to think they had isolated like a patient zero in China, in Wuhan. And then they found out that, you know, through a little bit more digging and a little bit more, you know, interviewing people who subsequently contracted the disease, that wasn't necessarily the case, that it could have been any number of people. And identifying patient zero is a pretty important step in this process, not because we want to like go blame that person. You will pay for this. No, but it's extremely helpful in being able to determine the rate that it spreads and be able to identify, you know, possible vulnerable communities who might be impacted by it. And so it's definitely portrayed in the movies to be a little bit simpler than it really is. But as we're going to see, it sort of depends on the film and what they're trying to accomplish. And, you know, keep in mind that movies are meant to entertain us and they are usually, you know, between 1.5 and 2 hours long. So what they can accomplish in that time is obviously pretty limited.
I think the one movie you listed here was 12 Monkeys, which it seems like it mostly boiled down to Bruce Willis, which is all of his movies, I think, by the way. It all boils down to Bruce Willis in every film.
Yeah. But, you know, we could do a whole episode on Bruce Willis. Right.
And the epic just 1990s like, film Armageddon, of course.
Well, of course. I was going to go there, too, of course. But I've also said we should do an episode about how much money it costs to save Matt Damon.
Yeah, because space programs.
Right, so many times, and he's in this list as well because he's in Contagion. So many times we have to save Matt Damon. But yeah, so 12 Monkeys. So when we look at science fiction depicting viruses and pandemics, 12 Monkeys is interesting because it involves this element of time travel, where you know Bruce Willis is sent back to the 90s to try to figure out that point of origin, like find patient zero. To stop a pandemic that almost wipes out humanity in the future. And so it's an interesting concept. I haven't seen it in a very long time, so there's certain details to it that I can't speak to, but it's kind of a harrowing look at what the near end of civilization would be like, you know, and this idea that, you know, all of it could have been stopped if not, you know, for that one person or that one moment. And, you know, the movie's got Brad Pitt, who's this kind of comic relief as the, he's a, like a wannabe eco-terrorist.
There's always a character.
Yeah, of course. There's always something like that. So, so it's an interesting look at just sort of a long-term scale of the devastation caused by a pandemic and, how hard it is to really find the origin. Yeah.
Well, it is. I mean, it's fascinating, though, to look at where we were, you know, in 1995 when the movie came out versus, say, you know, I think what was it in 2000? I'm trying to think of in 2003 when, you know, I think we were dealing, was it SARS at the time? And they were traced like an outbreak in Toronto from one woman who had flown in from Hong Kong. You know, just fascinating how, like, you know what I mean? Like in literally just about less than 10 years, probably our understanding of epidemiology accelerated very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Very quickly. And I think they even identified like what elevator button she pushed in her hotel. It was something, it was really specific with SARS. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Another one in this same category of science fiction. Now this movie came out in 2017 and disclaimer, I haven't actually seen this movie, but I read the book that it is based on. Well, I don't think it officially is.
Inspired by.
So the movie is Life that came out in 2017. It is, I think, inspired by Tess Gerritsen's book, Gravity. Mm-hmm. But Tess Gerritsen, I believe, I think there was a lawsuit about this, that it was inspired, but not necessarily with permission. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so kind of interesting. But the concept of this movie is you've got, let's see, who's in this? Jake Gyllenhaal, Ryan Reynolds, Rebecca Ferguson. And it's a crew on the International Space Station that finds the first sign of life on Mars. But the book originally was dealing with a 6-person crew on the International Space Station that was not looking for life on Mars, but they were basically handling a type of bacterium from the deep sea, interestingly enough. Wow. And that bacterium very quickly and frighteningly mutated in low gravity environment and became this awful, awful pathogen that destroyed the entire crew. And, you know, I don't like to give spoilers, but it goes badly. Yeah.
Well, then,
and it ends up back on Earth, of course. Is, so
that's fascinating because, you know, earlier you said something about your work looking at bacteria in your hydro vents, and it's I've never studied it, but like now being exposed a little bit to some of the coursework that I'm doing, I've learned that there are a specific set of conditions for certain things to happen. And that sounds like that's kind of the premise of the movie, is that in any other situation on Earth, that bacteria never behaved that way. And then when you bring it into a zero G environment, it behaves rather radically different.
It's a matter of not just, you know, when people think of mutation, they think of radiation,
like the Hulk,
physically changing like the Hulk, but they imagine that, you know, if they even think of it happening on the DNA level, because that's what we're talking about, but they imagine that it's changing the DNA. Well, it may not necessarily be doing that. It may be changing gene expression. Mm-hmm. And that is, that's something that was identified in the twin study with Scott Kelly and his twin brother, Mark, because they compared what happened, you know, physiologically, someone on Earth and their twin up in space over a prolonged time. One of the things they saw was a change in gene expression. Mm. And so, you know, most of your DNA is not expressing itself all the time. And so it's almost like flipping a switch to turn on the expression of some of those genes, which then results in a changed morphology or changed behavior or changed some changed phenotype of the organism. And so there's definitely some truth to the idea that, yeah, you could take something up there and it's hard to say exactly what will change about its expression when it's either exposed to, you know, less gravity or more radiation. What's interesting about deep sea bacteria is that they are, they're used to very, very little radiation. Right. And so that could be, I think that's probably why Gerritsen chose that for her writing. And it's a fascinating idea. The part that makes it more fiction than science is the idea that these changes will immediately result in something harmful, because when it comes to mutations, 90% of the time they do nothing. Right. Like you have mutations in all of your cells all the time. 90% of the time they do nothing. 10% of the time it could be something harmful like cancer, or it could confer an advantage. And so when we say advantage, that advantage is predicated on the environment that the organism is in. So it would have to, there would have to be more people than just six people on that station to be the hosts of this bacteria. And for the bacteria to evolve rapidly enough, you know, bacteria can evolve pretty quickly because they duplicate so fast, but for them to evolve rapidly enough to suddenly be harmful, would take a lot more time and a lot more people than was expressed in that movie. But it's still it's a good concept. I mean, it's a fascinating concept.
You can't have Ryan Reynolds in a movie if the mutation doesn't do anything, you know. I mean, I know this is mixing the book and the movie, but
right, but still, yeah. And I got to give a big shout out here, turning over to Star Trek for a second. Because StarTrek.com came out with this list of like Star Trek pandemic themed episodes. So go to StarTrek.com and they give a list of episodes that involve some kind of virus. And one of them in particular, this was one of my favorites from Next Gen, was Genesis. And you may remember it as the one where, comedically, the crew turn into all these crazy animals. Like Troy is some kind of amphibian and Riker is like, he goes full on Hulk, or he's like the Beast from Beauty and the Beast, or I don't even know. And Barclay is a spider. Like it's just,
why?
It's like, cuckoo bananas.
Cause I haven't watched it in a while. But like, why did they devolve into different species? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. So Well, here's the fun part of this. And this is the part that I mean, the episode itself is, it's okay, but the science behind what was happening was really cool. The idea was that Dr. Crusher gave Barclay this synthetic T cell, and your T cells are involved in your immune system, but they also can sort of trigger an immune response or any sort of cell response to something. And so what happened was this synthetic T cell was given to him to activate a dormant gene. And it turns out that T cell accidentally activated not just all of his dormant genes, but dormant introns. And if you, this goes back to high school biology a little bit, you're, after your DNA has been turned into RNA, so that it can be then expressed into proteins, it goes through this little editing process where it gets rid of essentially like junk sequences of DNA. We call those introns, and it silences them. So the idea behind this episode is that this rogue T cell is turning all of that on. And so instead of expressing just the normal evolutionarily derived genes, it's expressing genes that our evolutionary ancestors had that have been silent.
So the idea,
if that makes
then,
any
the sense. Idea is then that those genes would have been to things like the tarantula, the fish, like those sequencings would somehow have been a dormant part of our
right.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, it's not totally feasible, it's not feasible in terms of like how it manifested itself in the crew. But the part of it that's really interesting is that it kind of gives a shout out to the fact that our DNA is not just a blueprint of us right now. It's kind of a hidden map of our evolutionary history. Mm. And that part's true. And I'll give you an example of this. When you compare the developing embryo of a human to that of a turtle or a mm-hmm. fish or any other vertebrate, they look virtually identical, and then they start to differentiate after a while. But human embryos have gill slits and a long tail mm-hmm. because our ancestors, evolutionarily speaking, did as well. So those genes still turn on early on in our development, but then at some point they flip back off because we, you know, we air-breathing vertebrate mammals don't need gill slits, but those genes are still present. So that's kind of, that's the concept that came up in that episode. So I thought that was kind of cool. Well,
I was going to say it's kind of a big fish, but, and then I thought of Troy immediately. I mean, I guess, you know, for me, like I'm thinking of, you know, there's this book that Michio Kaku wrote, the futurist and scientist guy, and he talked about how identical human DNA is to each other. And that like, if you compared us to any other species, you know, the variance in DEA between like two chimpanzees is astronomical compared to human DNA,
right,
where the differences and deviations are so slight that we're almost identical. But that makes
right.
sense, like, you know, some of those possibly recessive traits. But it's just so strange that it would affect the whole crew in such various different ways, I guess.
Yeah, that part was fun. I don't think there was any methodology to that, but it was kind of cool.
Well, it's not a real episode unless there's a Neanderthal trying to break down the door of sickbay or something. So,
right? Yeah, I mean, just another day on the Starship Enterprise D.
Did you watch some of those other episodes?
Well, some of them I haven't seen in a while, but I remember the original series, Miri.
Okay.
Do you remember that episode? So they find a planet that's very Earth-like. They go beam down. So I think Kirk, Spock, and some red shirt plus McCoy go discover this gang of children roaming around the city. And they can't find any adults. And eventually they come across adults that look like monsters and die immediately. It was like there was some bizarre problem that they had, and they figured out that after the children go through puberty, they contract a virus that kills them.
Okay, that's intense.
And so then they all come down with the virus except for Spock.
Wow.
And I can't remember why. It's got to be a Vulcan Pon Farr kind of thing. I don't know, but Spock doesn't get it, and And so then they have, you know, it's sort of a Lord of the Flies situation, I guess, but they have this short amount of time to find a cure.
I'm surprised that they include Threshold, Star Trek Voyager, where...
That's a really good call. I was wondering that. They include Resolutions as one of the episodes here from Voyager.
Well, maybe the key was it had to be one of the best episodes of Star Trek covering disease. Obviously, that's not maybe one of the best ones of Star Trek ever. I don't know.
Maybe not. They have a few interesting ones. DS9, The Quickening was another one. Mm-hmm. That was that blight.
Okay.
That was they were trying to find a cure for. And then there was the other DS9 one where they what do they call that? Where you lose the ability to talk cohesively. Sure. Yeah. The episode was Babel, and that was kind of funny. They all just kind of progressively couldn't say anything sensibly. Yeah. Gosh, but what's that called? That disease? Aphasia? Is it aphasia?
I'm not familiar.
Aphasia, yeah. It damages the part of the brain that controls language. So you can't read or write or say what you're thinking.
Gotcha. I regularly see that every day in some Facebook posts that I read. Oh, that's terrible. We just lost 5 viewers, by the way.
See that all the time.
That's also probably, honestly, I feel like that has been a subject in like ER or, you know what I mean? Like that's probably been on an episode of Chicago Hope or something like that where somebody has that and they can't figure out what it is and, you know.
Right, yeah. Right. Of course.
Crazy. Yeah, well, that's great. So a list of Star Trek episodes to watch that people can check out on StarTrek.com.
Yeah, so some good sci-fi out there. For those of you that love sci-fi and viruses, or at least some kind of pathogen. So let's take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to serve you guys a nice, healthy dose of zombies.
Zombie lore coming up.
People love zombies. So coming up when we get back. Right. We're back to talk about zombies. And there's actually no shortage of movies that deal with zombies. Some of you guys may love them. Yeah. I've never been a huge zombie fan, gotta say.
Really?
Yeah, it hasn't really done it for me.
I've always enjoyed the movie. I mean, I'm a little freaked out by them, you know. I would never like cosplay as one. Like that's how much I'm opposed to zombies. But I've been fascinated by the stories and the books and the movies, but not for you.
Not so much for me. You know, that said, there are some movies and some stories that I've enjoyed with a zombie take, but in general it's not a thing for me. Mm-hmm. So over the years we've seen a lot of zombies tied in with this idea of a virus. And when COVID-19 first started to become a household name, people would mention zombie apocalypse, you know, like, this is it. This is our zombie apocalypse, except, you know, minus the zombie part and hopefully minus the apocalypse part.
Yes.
But essentially the concept there is that the virus kind of kills you, but not enough to really immobilize you somehow, keeps you in the state of undead so that the virus can do what viruses do and spread itself as rapidly as possible by taking over your brain and making you run out and grab other people and bite them and eat them. And am I leaving anything out?
Well, I got to tell you, if you know, we are not prepared for a zombie apocalypse because you know what I mean? Like the other day, I was in the supermarket and it was the first time in over a week that I actually saw any toilet paper in the aisle. And it was only one ply too. So there were like 10 rolls. And then I was in line to get into the drugstore because they don't allow more than 10 people in. And like this guy was like, "Do you guys have Tylenol?" And they're like, "No, we're all out." So, I mean, in all of these zombie movies, like they all have like, you know, these bunkers and like somehow they've been, you know, storing up a cellar worth of canned goods. Like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're definitely not prepared. But okay, correct me if I'm wrong, because as mentioned, I'm not a big zombie person, but don't you just have to shoot zombies in the head and then they're they're good,
supposedly, you know. And it's okay. It's interesting, there is a good article in Discover magazine that, you know, before they get into zombie talk, they try to identify exactly what a zombie is. So like, right, this guy, the author, makes this distinction that, you know, there are zombie stories where like a disease comes out or a nuclear thing happens and then people suddenly change and transform into something else. But for his work, he's agreed upon the, I don't know if you'd call it the academic term, that a zombie would have to be someone who died and then was reanimated.
And that is
the definition of a zombie, is they have to have died at some point and then be somehow reanimated. So
yeah. So what would allow them to be reanimated then? Is it like an energy source of some kind, or the virus like kickstarts their metabolism but doesn't bring them back to life?
I think so. I mean, you know, gosh, this guy does a much better job of explaining it than I ever would. It's an article called Delay the Decay, How Zombie Biology Would Work, by a guy named Kyle Munkittrick. So, you know, some of the things that are interesting about it is like, one of the things I'm learning in the class, and don't make fun of me because I know you've known this for ages probably, but pathogens, you know, kind of break into the walls sometimes of cells and latch onto our inner workings, essentially kind of hijacking existing systems to make them do other things, like replicate more of the pathogen. How did I do there? Was that more or less correct?
Yeah. No, that's okay. Exactly right.
I don't care if I pass the course online, as long as I get your stamp of approval, then I know I'm the right ballpark.
Accurate.
Well, what they're talking about in zombie lore is the idea that there would be a pathogen that hijacks the human system and then does several things, you know, I mean, somehow enables the body to continue to move. So like, there are things that obviously need to function in the body to allow that to happen. And then it also has to change its changing behavior, to where like it's, you know, the flesh eating or brain eating zombie, you know, whichever one you want to go with. It's modifying the behavior. So like, those things would be, incredible in a terrible sense if that happened to somebody who was alive, much less to something that has to die first and then be reanimated. So to me, like, mm-hmm. that's the point where zombie lore is unrealistic. It's because of the number of things that this pathogen is supposed to be able to do to like a human system that is deceased. You know, that's the part that makes it unrealistic.
Yeah. And to step way back for a minute and talk about what a virus actually is, it's not technically a living thing. Scientists kind of disagree on its classification because it doesn't metabolize. It literally can do nothing except replicate, and it can't do that on its own. It can only do that by taking over a host cell. So if that's its only capacity and its only objective, and it has a lot of complex ways that it does this, but ultimately if it's going to kill off its host or immobilize its host, it's unable to continue to spread.
Right.
And so not just killing the host, but then, like you said, all of these steps to reanimate it seems terribly inefficient for a organism that isn't technically even an organism because it's not alive and all it's trying to do is replicate itself. So, you know, there's some things that they do that, use symptoms that someone has that has a very deadly virus, like the spewing and coughing of sputum is part of the virus's way to get out and to infect another host. Mm-hmm. So it's like there's this delicate balance where it can't fully kill its host, at least not quickly, because it needs the host, but at the same time, it needs to be able to spread. And so in sort of balancing those two things, you're right, zombies don't really make sense.
Yeah. I mean, but they're great for Hollywood. They're great for stories, you know, obviously they're great for drama, but it is odd. And you know, it's also really interesting. There's, I can't remember which kind of disease that they were exploring. in the coursework that I'm doing, and they were talking about the introduction of a pathogen to the nostrils of a mouse, which I always feel really sad when they talk about things like that. But you know, there's a natural elements on the snout of this particular mouse that kind of prevent the pathogen from taking a hold. It's only when you completely eradicate any of the kind of colonies of existing microbes there and then place the pathogen that it actually takes hold.
Right.
And so that kind of maybe second guess how much I use hand sanitizer, maybe a little bit, but you know, it's like, again, like looking at that, there is a specific set of conditions that have to happen for a virus to take place,
right.
Or to be, I don't know what you would call it.
Infectious.
I don't want to say, yeah, infectious. I don't want to say successful, but infectious. And so it's like, you know, and that would be the same with zombie virus too, but at least in how it's depicted in Hollywood, everyone is equally susceptible, which is not normal for really most populations. I think when it comes to viruses that, you know, there are some people that are more susceptible than others. You know, like with COVID-19, people are looking at age, immunosystem, you know, immune response and how healthy that system is. But like, you know what I mean? Like, according to zombie Hollywood lore, anyone who gets bit is always going to be infected all the time.
Right. Right. And one of the defining factors when we talk about viruses, and especially coronavirus for its name, it's named after the fact that when you look at the virus under a microscope, and it's not just this virus, there's a whole category of coronaviruses that, I mean, everyone has probably contracted a coronavirus at some point, not necessarily, you know, not this coronavirus, but variations of them, and they're named such because the viral envelope, it's, if you will, which is the body of the virus, is sort of a circular shape, and it's got these receptors that cover it. And it makes this sort of a ring or corona shape. And those receptors essentially fit like a lock and key into our cells, which is how they're infectious. But like you said, they don't infect everybody the same way. Not everyone has the same locks, if you will, on their cells. Different, you know, there's a variety of reasons for that. It could be... It's not necessarily age that determines that, but your own genetics can determine what cell receptors you have and what you don't. Blood type is one of them. In fact, I read somewhere that there, I need to double check this in the last couple of days, but a few days ago, there was a study suggesting that people with type O blood might be less susceptible to coronavirus. So I don't know how solid that is as of now, but that if it's true, then it would be because of the receptors on the cells on your own cells versus those on the coronavirus.
Right. Right. And that's why, you know, I think, I mean, we'll look more at it in a little bit, but like the movie Contagion obviously would be, I mean, for so many reasons, drastically more realistic than really any zombie virus, because they do kind of visit upon the idea that not everyone is equally susceptible in the population. So,
right, exactly. Now, in this long list I have of zombie movies, I'm just going to rattle some of them off, and there's only a couple that address this issue. But I Am Legend is one that did address that somewhat, because I think some people were immune to it, right? Did you ever see I Am Legend? So
it was a long time ago, but yeah.
Yeah. So some people, that's, you know, Will Smith, last man alive, or so he thinks, and he's got his dog and living in New York City alone, and everyone else is a zombie. And he was, I believe he was immune, or some people were, some people weren't. But what's interesting about that movie came out in 2007, and it is actually inspired by two previous movies. The Last Man on Earth in 1964 and The Omega Man in 1971 with Charlton Heston. But all three of these movies were based off of Richard Matheson's 1954 novel, also named I Am Legend. His original novel was not about zombies per se. It was just about a plague that wiped out most of humanity. And so the three movies that were made from it have sort of different takes on that same concept. But okay, I believe Will Smith's I Am Legend did involve, like, some people are inherently immune because he finds other colonies of people who are still alive.
Right.
And who, right. Yeah. So, other movies, let's see, Dawn of the Dead, that was 1978, and then a remake in 2004.
Was that the remake? Is that the one that takes place in the shopping mall?
I believe so. I haven't seen the remake, but I think so. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Those are definitely, I think, from what I understand, more on the fictional side of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Resident Evil as well. That series came out between 2007 and 2017. 28 Days Later, and then the sequel was 28 Weeks Later, which came out in 2003 and 2007, respectively. And then the one everybody has been watching recently is World War Z, 2013. So most of these are pretty similar in terms of how they handle this concept of the zombie virus, and we've already kind of covered why that's problematic.
And not to be confused, I know that there's 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later. There's mm-hmm. also a Sandra Bullock movie called 28 Days, not a zombie film, by the way, not a zombie film.
No, it's a rom-com, isn't it?
Yeah, so don't get confused, like, yeah, guys, we're going to have, like, a zombie marathon, and then, like, you rent, well, nobody rents anything anymore, but, you know, 28
you
Days
stream.
Later with Sandra Bullock. But did you ever read, have you seen that book, World War Z?
I have not read it, no.
So the book, I enjoyed the movie, but the book is way more enjoyable to me than the movie was. And, I think you'd enjoy it. They basically, write it from the perspective of a United Nations researcher who's trying to go back and collect the anecdotal story, you know, the stories mm-hmm. of individual people who had survived through the worldwide zombie epidemic. They interview victims, they interview the military that tried to fight the zombies. They talk about how they tried to eradicate zombies, like moving across the country from west to east and east to west. It's a really good book. And it's actually written by the son of Mel Brooks, Max Brooks. So if you're looking for a good book, that's a good one to read. I think we also had a note in here for viruses or things that are similar to the zombie virus.
Yes.
I don't know if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah. So this one is awesome. It's actually something that I'll show my students when I really want to freak them out, or when they're like, parasites are boring. And I'm like, really? Watch this. And so there's this great video about it on, I think it's one of the Planet Earth episodes with the wonderful David Attenborough. But it's about a particular parasite. This is not a virus. This is a fungus, a parasitic fungus that infects ants. And it's very, very specific. Like, the type of fungus is called Cordyceps. There's several species of Cordyceps fungus, and each one infects only a specific species of ant or other insect. So there's not a lot of crossover. But what this fungus does is, if a fungus spore lands on an ant, so say you're an ant and the spore lands on you, that spore will then germinate more spores that get into your brain. And it starts to make you kind of slow down and act a little weird. And if the others in the colony, if other ants notice that you're acting a little weird, the first thing they do is they grab you and they take you as far away from the colony as possible, and they leave you for dead. Yeah.
So they get rid of you. They essentially isolate.
They isolate you as soon as possible. And, you know, kind of sorry to be you, but you're gone. You need to get away from the colony. Because what happens next is you start to feel like you're driven to do something you've never done before. And that thing is climb up a blade of grass or a stick or something, get as high as you can, at least 10 to 12 inches off the ground. And as an ant, that's your only objective in life, is to climb this blade of grass. And then you clamp your little ant jaws down on that blade of grass and you don't let go. And then you start to die. Oh, and what happens is that fungal spore will then germinate out of your head, and it will form something that, I mean, we couldn't even really make up in science fiction. It just sprouts straight up out of your head. That's and so then gross. It explodes more spores everywhere else. So that's why that the
a bad dandruff situation.
Yeah, exactly. But that's why the other ants have to get you as far away as possible, because
that's fascinating.
That fungus will then rain down more spores on any other ants that are close by and infect them.
That's incredible that they're able to detect that and then react to it.
Yeah, because this thing will, I mean, this is as close to a zombie as you can possibly come. You know, it starts to affect the ant's brain and behavior and thinking pretty much immediately to make it do what it wants it to do. So,
yeah, I mean, that would actually be like a good science fiction story in itself. But mm-hmm. I also am thinking like immediately of the 1998 animated film Ants.
Yeah.
With Woody Allen. And now I'm like, oh, no, that sounds so sad.
No, those poor ants. Yeah, no, it's crazy. Totally crazy. So weird stuff like that can certainly happen. You know, they say reality is stranger than fiction. And in some ways, that's very true, even if it hasn't happened to us Homo sapiens in the way that zombie folklore has been told in fiction. Weird stuff happens in reality totally. Like that. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. It's so funny, too, because like you think about like writers' rooms of science fiction shows and like, how can we come up with a good story? And it's like, well, you know, you really could just like look at National Geographic and probably grab some pretty cool stuff. You don't have to look too far. So
no kidding. Yeah, and I think some of them probably do in some ways, or at least if they're smart, they do.
Not the Lizard Voyager story, though.
No. Cool. So why don't we take one more break? And when we come back, we'll talk about some movies that, for the most part, get it right.
Awesome. Can't wait for it.
All right. We are back, and since we've been slamming a lot of movies in this episode, we're going to talk about some that do a pretty darn good job when it comes to portraying a pandemic or viruses in general and how that process seems to pan out.
Yeah, we're ready to talk about some of the movies that we'll say get it more right than others.
More right than others, right. Maybe not perfect, and that's okay, but pretty close. And these movies have turned up to be some of the most popular movies of the last few weeks.
Which is so weird to me. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, we're living it. I don't feel the need to watch it, but.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's sort of a morbid curiosity with, you know, okay, well, what exactly do people think can happen to us under these circumstances, or if it's more like, hey, remember that one movie that dealt with this? Oh yeah, you know, let's rewatch it. We have nothing else to do.
Because it's like I worry that, you know, it's like there's two places that people go to for all of their information. One would be obviously the news,
right?
And then the other one is like, well, let me watch a movie about it. And honestly, like, that's kind of why I started doing the online courses, because it's like, look, if I'm going to spend time watching videos about it, why not like learn something and then get a certificate from it in the end? You know what I mean? Like, if you tabulate the amount of time that the average American has spent watching news about COVID-19, you probably everybody could get the certificate. You know?
Probably. And, you know, I almost wish that for every type of movie that tries to pull off something scientific, that there was this degree of feedback from the scientific community, as as has been happening recently. Like, there have been a ton of articles coming out about Contagion and Outbreak and The Hot Zone and all these movies, and it's good because they're sort of setting the record straight about a lot of it. And I just wish that happened all the time for movies that try to talk about science. So the one that came out in 1995 was Outbreak. That was with
Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman. Thank you. I was like drawing a blank for a minute.
No.
Dustin Hoffman was in that one. And that one, I think there were some elements of it that were kind of a little bit overdone, like the way or the circumstances in which he was wearing a full hazmat suit to interact with people wasn't exactly accurate. But in general, this movie seemed to get it pretty close. It's an Ebola-like virus, spreads to the U.S. from an African village. And I think Dustin Hoffman is one of the virologists.
Yeah. And then Cuba Gooding Jr., I think.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot that Cuba was in this too. Morgan Freeman, I think, too, right?
Yeah. Those were the days.
So it seems kind of, this movie was trying to portray, I think, the not just the devastating effects of the virus on patients who have it, but on the process of trying to prevent it from spreading and trying to determine what exactly, you know, what are some of these characteristics of the virus? How is that going to play out, and how should we try to contain the spread of it? There was a lot of issues with like the military and the government agencies were having to go to pretty intense lengths in this movie. So I think that part of it, the sort of procedural part, was pretty accurate from what I understand. Mm-hmm. So that was a pretty good one.
I watched that movie. It's got to have been several times. And I mean, aside from the acting, I thought was really, really good in it as well. But that definitely was like the first movie that I ever saw that kind of depicted, you know, a virus and the panic that can come with it and the scare of it and everything.
Right. Yeah. Sort of the hysteria. And it really, it's kind of interesting now because we look at, you know, how many times in the news did we hear about coronavirus as a thing that was happening overseas? You know, something that's happening in China. It's not something that's affecting us in the United States just yet. And, you know, for some of us, me included, the first time I heard about it, the first place my brain went was, okay, this is another SARS or MERS situation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not going to sweep us to the extent that we fear. But here we are. But Outbreak kind of looked at what that looked like on the ground, like dealing with that virus on site looked like.
And I think that, again, that's, you know, as right as they get so many things, you know, that's one of those movies where I mentioned earlier, like they are very focused on one specific thing that's needed to fix the whole problem.
Right.
Whereas, you know, like I think, you know, what we're seeing now is like, well, okay, like, even if you have a course of treatment for someone, you know, you need to have the ability to do it, to test it. Because very interestingly, like, I think almost all of the movies that we're going to list in this category all had an element of, like, and spoiler alert, so for anyone who hasn't seen Outbreak, Contagion, or The Hot Zone, spoiler alert, but they all involve a element of someone self-testing a vaccine that they just created.
Right.
Yeah, which is procedurally, like, that's pretty unconventional, I would say.
I mean, there's no way to control variables to ensure that it's even working. I mean, that's one of the things, like, you can't say with any certainty that it's not just anecdotal. If you're just testing it on one person, and if you're not, if the data of, you know, is not being recorded properly by someone else, by an objective third party.
Right.
So yeah, there's a lot of issues with that. Now jumping to Contagion. Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. No, it's true. Contagion, which is my personal favorite, of these movies, Contagion hits so many things correctly about this. Now in the movie Contagion, they're dealing with a very different type of virus than we are right now. I think the virus they were dealing with was something Ebola-like, but it was, you know, attacking the same things, their nervous system and brain. But it was actually had like a 20% mortality rate, something like that in Contagion, like 20% of people died. And then it also included the fact that I think a third of people were immune, like Matt Damon's character was immune to it, had no, you know, he could come into contact with it and it didn't affect him. So it put that element of it into play. And what the movie does really well is it shows from start to finish, you know, what happens at the origin of the virus, and this sort of ecological side of this comes into play. Because the more habitat destruction that we incur on this planet, the more we actually drive infectious diseases into our lives.
Yeah.
And that is that's a variable that we can't continue to ignore. And they really highlight that in Contagion. You know, this starts with bats and pigs, just like COVID-19. And it happens, and we kind of see this at the end of the movie. I know it's another spoiler, but at the end of the movie, they show sort of the point of origin. Like they kind of go backwards and they show this is where it started. And it has to do with the bulldozing of some forest, and those bats leave the forest and they end up in a barn with pigs, and there's fecal matter and so on and so forth. And then the pig ends up in a butcher shop in China. And Gwyneth Paltrow is she's not patient zero, but she's like one of the first three people that come into contact with it. So that's one of the things that they really get right, is just that connection between another mammal that can, you know, usually a virus stays kind of contained among species, mm-hmm. but it makes the jump. Right. In Contagion, it's a novel virus, novel in that it's new to the human species. It just recently made a jump from some other animal to human. And COVID-19 did exactly the same thing under almost exactly the same circumstances.
I think there's a line that I wrote down that one of the doctors in the film, and she just says, the wrong bat like met with the wrong pig at the wrong time.
Right, exactly.
Again, going back to the very specific set of circumstances that have to happen for a jump like that to happen. And they actually do it in Hot Zone, where you can actually trace back what type of strain of, you know, the virus is active, you know, from a particular point where it jumped or transitioned. But yeah, I think for me, one of the things that I love about this film is that they spend a little bit of time, not a lot, but talking about what the reproduction number is, you know, or the R naught.
Yes.
I thought that was really great that they did that. And for our audience that has not heard that term before, that is like a mathematical expression of the potential infections that can occur from one infection. And so, like, I don't know, is there a reproduction number for COVID-19?
I think the last time I saw it was between 2.5 and 3.
Okay, that's high. To me, that sounds high. I mean, not high and like I don't believe it, but, you know, normally I'm thinking of reproduction numbers between like 1 and 2. And a lot of times those repro numbers are like 1 point, you know, and then you're kind of like, how does it affect 1.8 people, you know? But if that's the case, that is the reason why we have to worry about this more than maybe some other things in the past.
Right. Yeah. So the R naught, the reproduction number, is basically, if it's less than one, then each infection will cause less than one new infection, and you can expect that the disease will decline on its own. Mm-hmm. If it equals one, then the disease will stay alive, but is stable, like there wouldn't be an outbreak or epidemic. So an R naught value of one or less is kind of normal. I'm not going to say flu, because the flu is actually more than that. But it's sort of normal pathogen interactions that don't cause a massive scale infection. So if R naught's more than one, then each infection is going to cause more than one new infection, and it will spread to the extent of an outbreak or a pandemic is likely. So here's the thing, though. The R naught value can change. It's not a separate thing. And it only applies when everyone in a community is completely vulnerable to the disease. And for COVID-19, we don't necessarily know that that's true.
Right.
Because that means that no one's been vaccinated, which is true in this case, because we don't have a vaccine for COVID-19. No one has had the disease before. That's also true. And there's no way to control the spread of the disease. Now that's where our actions right now come into play, because we could literally change the R naught of the disease by doing what we're doing through social distancing and through trying to prevent, you know, that spread. So just for a little bit of background here, the R naught value of the Spanish flu, the 1918-1919 Spanish pandemic, Spanish flu pandemic. It was not a pandemic in Spain. It was in the United States.
Yes.
The R naught value was between 1.4 and 2.8. Let's see, H1N1 was between 1.4 and 1.6. And so anyway, that's just kind of the, some of the most recent R-naught values. Ebola is 2. Measles is 18. Measles has an R-naught value of 18. So,
and I think with obviously like that's so, but then when you throw in things like vaccines, then that can, because I think one of the things too that they talk about is the susceptible population, right? So,
right.
Yeah. But yeah, that's a scary number.
It's a scary number. And that's why vaccination is so crucial to society, because that R-naught value of 18, man, is devastating for measles. Now, SARS is approximately 4. So that's pretty consistent with where we are with coronavirus being between 2.5 and 3. Coronavirus is very, very similar to SARS from everything we know about it genetically. Yeah, so that's the R-naught. And yeah, contagion, there's this scene where Kate Winslet is, you know, on a whiteboard and she's explaining the R-naught value and what this means and how they can't really make any progress with this virus unless they know what its R-naught value is. And that's going to take time to establish.
And by the way, did not like Kate Winslet since Titanic, but I mm-hmm. did like her in Contagion. So
she was great. Yeah, she was great in Contagion. It was really good. And so she, her character was, you know, one of the heroes of the movie in that she, you know, worked very tirelessly, kind of on the front line, interviewing people who had contracted the disease and trying to figure out, you know, the spread and figure out how many people were getting infected in a given time, and it cost her life. Yeah. So, you know, we have to keep that in mind when we think about people in our own lives, healthcare workers, and those who are doing the same, who are on the front line of this particular pandemic, and that they are taking that same risk.
Absolutely. I mean, I saw a number that specifically like 550 NYPD members have been diagnosed with COVID-19, and about 4,000, I think, are out sick currently. Jeez. So that's just in our city, you know, for people who don't understand, you know, some folks who live in different parts of the country may not see the effects of it so quickly, but,
right.
You know, another way to the interesting thing that it kind of brings up is in that film, they develop a vaccine. Again, spoiler alert, but it has been a long time. It's been a decade. You know, they develop a vaccine and then they go through like a lottery process of, you know, birth dates of people born on like March 10. Okay, like you get the vaccine on day one and people born on, you know, whatever the other dates they pick. You know, there's two ways to address like who gets resources in a time like that. And one is certainly like the homogeneous approach that like everybody gets everything all at once. And then the other thing is to look at who you might call like a super spreader in a community. So the person who is the most infectious and the person who has the most contacts with other people.
Right.
So another way for our Star Trek fans to kind of look at this is, and I'd be curious to know, and for our audience, we have not talked about this before we are recording this today. So putting you on the spot, Meredith, but who do you think, who would you feel on the Enterprise D on the bridge would have the greatest potential to spread a virus on the bridge itself in like an 8-hour shift? Okay, why would you say Riker?
I'm just kind of ragging on Riker for
why? He's so cool.
Well, okay, well, first of all, he's very touchy. Have you noticed that?
Okay, there's
Riker. He's a little up close. He puts his hand on Data or Wesley's shoulders a lot, kind of up close, swinging that leg around all the time. That's necessarily going to spread a disease, but he's pretty touchy.
He puts his feet on the consoles a lot, and you know, bottom of his shoes have kind of been dirty, you know.
Yeah, of course. What does that even mean on a starship?
That's true. I mean, there are the biofilters, you know, on the but taking that aside, see, I actually agree with you that I did this kind of pecking order. I think that whoever is at the helm in the con, so if it was like Data and Ensign Crusher, they would, you know, when you look at an individual person in a network, you could call them a node, and the number of connections they have to potentially spread a virus to other people is called an edge. So the number of edges that each of these crew members would have, I think, you know, Ensign Crusher and Data would be low. But I definitely agree with you, because Riker, he's, you know, walking around the horseshoe portion of the bridge, sitting right down in his chair, walking, you know.
He's at tactical a lot. He goes up there and is like looking over Worf's shoulder and, you know, yeah, second guessing him on something, and Worf grumbles back, but he's up there a lot.
But I actually, so to me, I think like Riker was definitely up there, but to me, Worf, because not only, like, you would think that he only stays at the horseshoe, which is true, like, you know, where he stands behind that tactical station, but he's the only person on the bridge that if he sneezes or coughs, he's in an elevated position where those droplets literally fall on three people directly in front of him. And that would be the captain, the counselor, and Riker.
So he has like a viral vantage point.
Yeah. So, and the average human, you know, I think they say has about 40,000 droplets in every sneeze. I don't know how many a Klingon has. Worf's big guy. So he would be the person, like, if I had one surgical mask to give to someone on the bridge, Worf would get it before anyone else. You know, I think, you know, but that's just my assumption. So
that's a fair position to have on that. That makes a lot of sense.
Now then when you, then I took this down the rabbit hole. So then I thought about, like, well, in engineering, the issue there is that there's really only two consoles that are used, and they're more or less communal. And so everyone is touching the same console versus the bridge, where everyone has individual consoles.
That's true.
Yeah. Pretty bad. Pretty bad. So.
Yeah. That's a kind of a fun thought experiment, is, you know, think of your favorite, you know, ensemble cast on a TV show and ask yourself, which one of them?
It turns out, by the way, that Barclay is the least one you need to worry about, because he has almost no social contacts. So that's mean. That's terrible.
He spent his time in the holodeck envisioning Deanna Troi.
Yeah, well, you have to have friends to come into contact with to be able to do things. So that's terrible. Wow.
No, right. We can keep ragging on Barclay. I don't think many of our listeners will really disagree with that.
But he saved Voyager, though. We'll give him credit for that.
He can have credit for that. That's true. Yeah. So, wow. That's kind of a cool little experiment there. So one more thing I want to talk about Contagion. I'm still on it. Because there's one other part of this that's really interesting. So the movie poster for Contagion, there's several of them, but do you know what the tagline is, or is that the right term, the tagline, like the main quote on the movie poster?
No, you know, I haven't looked at it in a really long time.
Okay, the tagline is, nothing spreads like fear. You know, we have two things sort of happening simultaneously. You've got the actual virus spreading like crazy, people getting sick, people dying. The CDC and WHO and everybody's scrambling to catch up. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you also have this guy, Jude Law's character. He's a blogger, and he's got some corporate interests. But he's kind of stirring the pot a little bit in terms of, you know, oh, there's really a cure, but they're keeping it from you. There's really a cure, but, you know, only people who are in with the WHO or the CDC are getting it. And by spreading those ideas, by planting that fear in the community, or at least in his followers, he ends up generating a massive panic and a rush on, I think they called it Forsythia, was a drug that he claimed was the cure. And he, as it turns out, he had, you know, obviously had some financial connections with the company that made Forsythia, but he claimed to test it on himself. And as it turns out, he never had the virus in the first place. So he lied to everyone. You know, he goes on his blog and he's pretending that he's sick and he's testing it. And, oh, look, Forsythia cured me. So what he did was he caused a huge panic and people rushing to every store they can to buy this stuff. And, you know, lives were cost, I'm sure.
Yeah.
With process. Yeah. And so the element of panic and fear is the other side of this film that is extremely accurate and something that we're dealing with now. You know, you talk about people rushing out and getting toilet paper like crazy, which is still, it's kind of interesting how that kicked off in the first place. But that's something we have to manage and mitigate just as much as we do the actual disease.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, people, you know, it is, and I want to try and stay positive, but, you know, it is eternally very surprising to me in this age of data and information where, you know, even tonight, as we've been recording this and talking about things, we're both actively looking up things on our computer to make sure that, you know, the information that we're putting out there, like we're not a science show. We're a show about science and science fiction. Mm-hmm. We're not, you know, a medical program, but we're making an effort to make sure that the information we put out comes from somewhere. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for us to be informed about what's going on. One of the issues in detecting viruses is not just surveillance, but when it comes to doctor-patient interaction, the patient's ability to effectively communicate what their symptoms are. You know, right. So I think, I mean, no one expects us as lay people to be experts in the field of medicine, but to be good patients at a time where medical resources are strained, like I think personally, one of the best thing people can do is understand what the symptoms are and know how to describe what you're feeling to your healthcare provider to reduce the diagnosis time, to like reduce the amount of time that, you know, a doctor has to spend with a patient, and to more accurately place you in like that pipeline is just so important. So it's like everyone wants to do something. And, you know, there's all kinds of good efforts and initiatives going on. But like if every person, obviously stay at home, wash your hands, but learn what the symptoms are and try to learn how to describe symptoms to a doctor. I think that could be so helpful, you know?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And the CDC on their website actually has a kind of a questionnaire, a coronavirus self-checker. And it's basically just a guide. It's not a diagnostic tool. It's not going to say you have it or you don't have it. And it kind of makes you like agree, like, you know, I agree that this is not a medical diagnosis, but it takes you through a series of questions so that you can not only, you know, let's say you're starting to feel sick at home, that maybe you could eliminate some anxiety and some fear by going through the checklist. But it also, like you said, it helps you know what to look for and to be able to articulate and verbalize what it is that you're experiencing when you do go to the doctor.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a great thing if people can do it, you know, and yeah, that's a great segue into that discussion of that tagline, nothing spreads like fear.
Right. Exactly.
And I don't know what the reproduction number is for that, but it's pretty high.
It's pretty big. Yeah. That would actually be an interesting project. Find the R naught value for panic.
Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, because if you also look at, you know, just wellness in general and the things that tie into that, but, you know, definitely, I mean, being informed and aware of these things, and we all have the ability to access that. So we strongly recommend it.
Yep, exactly. Go to the CDC website. So one last film, it's kind of recent. It just popped up onto Netflix, is The Hot Zone.
Yeah. Did you watch the whole thing?
I have not watched the whole thing. I've seen most of it. But I actually, so it's based off of Richard Preston's book, which I read a couple of times. And I actually had my AP bio class read it a couple of years back. And that book was focusing on the Marburg virus, which is a sort of a cousin virus of Ebola. And it's a nonfiction book. It's telling a true story. It did receive some criticism for sort of the graphic nature in which it describes the symptoms, that it might not be. It might have been a little bit exacerbated. So the book has received some pushback from the scientific community. And it is a really graphic book. Like, don't eat while you're reading it. It's
really? Okay.
It's intense, but it follows one man from a bat cave in Central Africa, and his flight home, and the symptoms are just unbelievable, and how that virus spreads. Now the hot
it's
zone.
Always with the bats. It's always
the bats. So this is really interesting. I actually had this conversation with AP Bio. Why bats? Why is it that bats seem to be sort of at the crux of all of this?
Sure.
And there's actually some interesting genetic factors as to why bats can house and tolerate so many viruses without themselves dying from them so easily.
Why is that?
They say on average, each species of bat actually has 1.8 zoonotic viruses, okay, compared to rodents, which have like 1.48, because rodents are the other species that we tend to get sick from, partially just from proximity. So, okay, so why do bats, why do they have this capacity? For one thing, they live really close to one another. So they spread just like humans live close to one another. In the winter, we spread the flu like crazy. So bats have the ability to spread viruses quickly. The difference being it's not lethal for them. And this actually gets into their ability to fly, interestingly enough. So it takes a lot of energy to fly. It's hard to do, requires a high metabolism, not something everyone can do. Bats are unique because they're mammals that can fly. And so when there's a lot of energy that goes into that, waste is produced. And by waste, I mean metabolic waste in cells, not just bat guano, but waste within cells. So to prevent that cellular waste from damaging their DNA consistently, they've evolved these defense mechanisms. And that defense, that way that the DNA is able to sort of defend itself against the byproducts of all this metabolic activity, means that they also can defend themselves against viruses really, really, really well. So it's kind of it's a funky byproduct of flight, of all things.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So kind of interesting. And there's actually I can cite the study here. Let's see, Peng Zhu and his colleagues in a paper published in the Journal of Cell, Host, and Microbe. And these scientists were at, wait for it, the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China. Yeah.
That's so
there you have it. There's some irony there. And yeah, I'm looking at, Healthcare in America. This was an article that came out in 2018, talks a little bit about it. And there's a link, I can put it in our show notes for those who are interested. But it's kind of interesting that information came out of Wuhan, isn't it?
It's kind of funny. I'm just imagining, like, because these viruses have some crossovers with bats, that like maybe there should be an episode of, I don't know, a Batman comic book where like Gotham discriminates against Batman ridiculously because of a virus that's being spread by bats. Don't come back, Batman.
Don't defend our city, disgusting, yeah. Batman with all your viruses.
And as ridiculous as that sounds, obviously we both know things like that are going on now, which is terrible and ridiculous as well. But
yeah, and that goes in with the whole spread of fear thing.
Yes, yeah.
People want to blame, and they want to have some sort of a sense of protection against something. And unfortunately, that makes us become very discriminatory, and that's a real shame, because it is certainly not the fault of any particular group of people on this planet that this happens. It is, in some ways, the fault of all people on this planet, in the sense that deforestation and habitat loss is one of the driving forces of these viruses. But the fact that this originated in China is not a new thing. It just happens that's where we have these bats in close contact with livestock, just as we do in parts of Central Africa. And we do in the United States, but you know, there's other variables, temperature and such, that can affect whether or not that happens.
Yeah, I am the most fearful, I guess, so now I'm giving into it, but there are those articles that you read about things that have been long frozen in the Arctic or Antarctic Circle. And as, you know, global warming happens, these things begin to defrost, and there could be pathogens in there from, you know, centuries ago,
right,
that we don't have vaccines and immunology to. But so not to give into the whole fear factor of this whole conversation, but, you know, you're absolutely right. That there are a number of factors that contribute to conditions, and it's not just one thing. And it's very easy for us to want it to be just one thing, because that's, you know, how Facebook conditions us to either like or dislike. You know, things can only be liked, disliked, or make you sad or happy, and like that's it. You know, like those are right, the only options. But it's a litany of things, and crazy stuff.
Absolutely crazy. So Wow, we've covered a lot of things. We've covered science fiction, we've covered zombies, we've covered some of the more realistic portrayals of viruses, but ultimately, like we sort of alluded to before, we're living it out now, and reality might be even stranger than fiction.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we did a long episode this time around just because we haven't talked in so long and there's a
Right.
lot to talk about, you know. So
Yeah.
yeah, that as people are working from home, maybe you have this playing in the background and it gets you through lunch.
We hope so. We hope so. We hope that that everyone has something to sort of connect to and to ground them to their sense of normalcy. And if we're playing any part in that, then that makes us very happy. So the next time we talk, we are going to look at Star Trek Picard, yeah?
Yeah, it's the season is over. The first season of Picard is over. Lots of stuff to talk about.
Oh, I can't wait. It's awesome. We actually, our last episode, we were like, hey, Picard's about to happen. And
And
we're
now
like,
it's
hey,
over.
Picard's over. But seasons of TV shows are so short now. They're like 8 to 10 episodes. I mean, come
Right. It's not like the 20 episodes that you used to have before, and
Right, exactly. So we will have an entire episode about Picard, and we haven't forgotten the fact that there's been some pretty interesting space things happening recently. So we will be covering those, maybe sort of synchronously with Picard if it's relevant. But in our upcoming months, you guys will be hearing from us.
Definitely sounds good, and I'm looking forward to it. I might need to get more costumes. I don't know, a Picard costume or something.
Yeah, I know. We'll just keep buying costumes. It'll make us feel better. And
Yeah, I don't have we don't have anywhere to wear them to or anything, but
just keep our fingers crossed about STLV. Maybe we'll
yes,
be through this by then, and we can be there, we hope. So
yeah,
we'll see.
definitely.
Yeah. All right. So until next time.
Yep, live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.